Hey, Al Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thingamajig. It's my radio show. I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is my website. Keep all my interview archives there. Almost 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And got some good ones lined up for you today. Adam Morrow and Mohammed Sahimi are coming up. But first, MJ Rosenberg. He used to work, and I'm sorry to always bring this up, MJ. I don't mean to embarrass you, but he used to work for the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and now he's one of America's greatest critics of their politics. And it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome back. The website is mjrosenberg.com. J like the blue J, like the name J. Right. Not just the initial, mjrosenberg.com. Welcome back.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be back.
Well, man, I was having the greatest time reading your blog this morning. I mean, I had already read a couple of things in the last week that made me want to have you on the show, but then I decided to go back and read a few more, you know, kind of in preparation. And I was just laughing at "They Suffer Alone" and all of your reveling in the neocons' pain this week.
I know. I think that this has been a really good couple of weeks for those of us who cannot stand the neocons and their influence in American foreign policy. I mean, it's almost separate from what happened in Syria, or what isn't happening in Syria, which is a separate an issue on its own. The big thing that happened domestically is that AIPAC, you know, the lobby, just fell flat on its face. The could not deliver a single vote to support the idea of bombing, which is just like awesomely amazing.
Okay, now what exactly do you mean by that? Couldn't deliver a single vote? Because there were some people who were willing to vote for it.
Yeah, but they were willing to vote for it before AIPAC went up there. I mean, what happened was, you know, Obama read the handwriting on the wall, so others he didn't have the votes. In fact, he had you know, hardly any. I think in the House he had well under 100 who were committed to supporting, and a couple of and 200 who were opposed to supporting the bombing. So he turned to AIPAC in a really kind of an unprecedented way. I mean, the administration went to them directly and asked them to lobby for this because, you know, as you know, they can put over anything. And it got lots of press attention. I mean, the AIPAC called for a big lobbying day in which, you know, the day before the vote was going to be, and hundreds of people came to Washington to, you know, descend on the Capitol and see every single member of Congress, both House and Senate. And the numbers changed not at all as a result of their visits. In fact, some people who are usually on their side, Ben Cardin, Henry Waxman, and the leader of the no forces, the no bombing forces, Alan Grayson from Florida, who's a good progressive, but is usually just awful on this issue. I mean, always on the issue of, you know, always supporting AIPAC. He was the leader against them. So, I mean, this has never happened before. Had they been able to deliver the way they normally could, the president would have been able to bring this thing up for a vote and pass it. But they couldn't deliver. And Alan Grayson, when asked why not, he acknowledged all their power. He also acknowledged he's very close to them. He said, but when the people speak in a clear voice, AIPAC can't do anything about it. In other words, the polls overwhelmingly showed the public against it, so AIPAC didn't have an impact, even with all the votes that they buy and all that. Couldn't do it.
Right. Yeah, it's really something else. It just goes to show how much power the American people have if they're good on something all at the same time. I mean, that's pretty unprecedented, huh?
I know, it's kind of unfortunate that we couldn't, you know, another issue that the American people feels just as strongly about is sensible gun control. Unfortunately, the NRA gives no indication that it's wobbly at all.
See, that's funny, because I'm exactly on the opposite side of that argument. I'm for disarming the state, not the people.
Actually, if you disarm the state, okay, I can see it.
Yeah, and they're the most violent force on the face of the earth, as you might have noticed.
Oh, I think I noticed, but they're a little bit less violent as a result of the people speaking out in the last couple of weeks. And what really is good about this is if AIPAC couldn't put over what was it that John Kerry called like a teeny-weeny little word?
Yeah, minuscule or something?
A minuscule, or we're so small you could barely see it except for the microscope. If they couldn't put that over, they think they're able to sell the American people on a big regional war with Iran? That ain't going to happen.
Right,
and, you know, well. And they're now trying to get more sanctions, which they'll be able to get because they can get which are terrible. Sanctions are just terrible, totally punish the Iranian people, don't do anything about proliferation or anything like that. But AIPAC can get that because it doesn't involve war. So they got a big sanctions thing passed and they'll have Obama support and all that. And they'll say, look, well, we can still get a war with Iran anytime we want it. But they can't. They can get everything except a war. And what they want is a war.
Well, and yeah, I mean, that was the war party, John McCain, especially him and Lindsey Graham. That was their big argument was if we don't follow through with this red line threat that we made against the Syrians, then the Iranians won't take us as seriously when we threaten them. And so
right.
Then Obama had to come out and say, oh, no, believe me, my threats against Iran all still stand regardless of what we do here in Syria.
And Kerry, the first place he goes to explain the U.S. position on all this now. So yesterday he was in Israel, standing there with a very glum and threatening looking Netanyahu, who was like, you know, and we always have to appease the Israelis. Kerry's a disgrace. I mean, he's a buffoon in my opinion. I mean, he bloviates one way and then he bloviates the other way. But the point is, this is maybe America just won't be able to draw as many red lines. Maybe some, you know, we've taken away their magic marker. I don't know. I mean, this is really good.
Yeah. Well, I wonder. You think how bad do you think that this really will hurt them for the? You think that, you know, for example, like on the case of Iran, that this has really cut their legs out from under them?
Well, first of all, you can never underestimate them in terms of what, you know, what they can do and what they can, you know, make happen. I mean, Israel was ambivalent about the Syria thing, and for good reason, because Syria under Assad basically has left Israel alone. I mean, it's been a peaceful border for 30 years. It was more like the lobby was the one that was pushing this because, you know, they were doing it for Obama and to show their strength. But when it comes to Iran, Netanyahu is out of his mind. He definitely wants a war. And what he's going to be doing now, what he's actually there, he is doing it already. He's saying, if the United States is not going to do it, we're going to do it. And you know, here's the thing. Suppose the issue could be that we wake up one morning and that Israel has attacked Iran. And then what happens? It's a fait accompli for them, but they can't finish the job. So what happens? The United States then has to make a decision. And at that point, who knows? At that point, most, I hate to say this, it's because it goes against all my optimism before, but if the Israelis just attacked first, all these people in Congress would go rushing down to the floor of the House and Senate and saying Israel's been attacked and we have no choice but to support them. Yeah, I know Israel would be doing the attacking, but that is not the way because they would call it a preemptive strike. Mm-hmm. But I could see, you know, so there are, I mean, the ways that the lobby operates are pretty tangled. Yeah, I mean, as happy as I am right now, I can, you know, I put nothing past them.
Yeah, well,
Or Netanyahu. I mean, the man, I mean, it's really incredible because there are all these videos coming out of Israel, I mean, on YouTube and everything, of people lining up for gas masks. And they were, you know, the public was so, you know, worried about a war. But that, they're about it. The Israeli government is about, you know, this, you know, it doesn't, Netanyahu is an ideologue. He's not worried about what the people think. He wants a war with Iran because, Iran, you know, Israel wants to be the only, only regional power, the dominant regional power. And it's going to be hard to get him off that, and it's going to be hard, and he's probably going to be in office for another 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. You think, though, that he's better than the American neocons and the American Israel lobby on Syria? I mean, I would definitely follow your line of argument there that, geez, if you and me were running that country, we would certainly not want a regime change in Syria, because, as you said, Assad, geez, he might as well be Mossad. He's fine.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, there's the whole Yanan plan and the clean break and expedite the chaotic collapse, David Wurmser and all that kooky stuff about just smash the whole Arab world and then they'll never be able to resist us again. It seems like Netanyahu's been kind of flip-flopping back and forth on that to me.
Oh, no, Netanyahu is essentially an American neocon. I was distinguishing between the Israeli government and the Israeli people. The best way to think about it, he barely is Israeli. You know, he grew up here. He was educated here. His English is, you know, as you can tell, impeccable. And
So it'd be like if you gave Richard Perle a state.
Yeah, exactly. He's no more Israeli than Richard Perle, and he doesn't reflect what Israelis think any more than Richard Perle. Unfortunately, Israel does have the right wing has been growing there just the same as it's been growing here. I mean, it used to be one thing you could usually count on about Israel was that the military was not as right wing as even right wing governments. But now even the government institutions there are all right wing. So it's they're losing the progressive types are leaving for wherever they can go. I mean, they have more people leaving Israel these days than going to Israel. I mean, and leaving from all places, not just the United States, but which is hard to get into to emigrate here, but Germany, which is very easy to emigrate to, and is getting now the Jewish population of Germany is almost at the same point it was before Hitler. Who would have thought that it would get so dismal in Israel that Israelis of German descent are wanting to go back there?
Yeah, a lot of Russians, too, going home.
Yeah, it's just like people who went to Israel, to Israel from Europe weren't going there just to have endless war and see their kids. And a country that's biggest aspiration now is a gigantic war with Iran. It's really, it's nuts. It's really nuts, but who knows if the American people seem to be waking up? Maybe that's what I really love about this. It's you have the progressive left and the Tea Party both against this. That's kind of against the Syrian thing. If we can have that same thing going on with Iran, we can really change this country. I mean, I don't really care what the Tea Party thinks about other things. If they're going to turn out and be anti-war, that's fine. We can make a coalition with them.
Right.
On that one issue.
Well, we're going to have to keep Democrats in power for that to remain the same, because you see what happens when Republicans are in power. We go all of a sudden, Republicans leave all that splendid isolationism behind and embrace militarism again.
No, that's true. That's true. But
don't give them a Jeb Bush to follow. They'll follow them right off the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And so it's it's not necessarily good that Obama is weakened so politically now. I mean, he got congressional elections coming up. Who knows? I mean, he really blew it. He really, his leadership over this Syria thing, well, there was no leadership. It was totally inept.
At least it ended in him backing down. What I was counting on. It was not wisdom,
well,
but cowardice.
True.
He backs down on everything. Let's hopefully he'll back down on this horrible thing, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Usually he backs down on good things.
Right. Yeah, he'll follow through on escalating the war in Afghanistan, but...
Right. And then he backs down on Larry Summers. So, which demonstrates that he's not going to have the juice anymore to put his, to do all his, coddling of the right and the banks and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I just feel much better about the way things are going now today than I did a month ago. The Syria thing is the first time that I can remember that the American public have spoken out against a war and made it so that it couldn't happen. I mean, that happened with Vietnam, but that was way at the end. Right. You had all those years of war. But it's just like Obama could make speeches and everybody could make speeches, and he had his Republicans lined up, you know, the interventionist Republican types. It didn't make a difference. The public, it just seems to me the American public has absolutely no interest in any more wars in the Middle East.
Well, you know, on your blog, you had that great quote from Aaron David Miller, is that right, about the American people now have their own level of expertise and their own ability to judge whether they think a war is worth it or not. They're not deferring to D.C. anymore, and they've decided, no, you can't have another one.
Right. That's extraordinary. I mean,
yeah,
it really
that's
is.
Really something.
And a president, you know, I mean, the idea that a president can go, first of all, he couldn't even give the speech he wanted to give. It's just like he had to give. I didn't even know why he gave that speech in the end. But they, you know, traditionally, the president gives a speech. He says when it's an international issue, not a domestic issue, but on the international issue, he gives a speech, says this is in the U.S. interest, and the American people to say, well, we'll defer to the president on this. Well, they didn't. Now, you're right. The thing that is worrisome, though, is that you don't know that this would apply if there was a Republican president. You know, it's like, you know, God knows the language that, the way they kind of get us into these wars. Yeah. It just could be that Obama isn't nearly as sophisticated as you say, Jeb Bush would be.
Well, you know, the liberals, the progressive left, not necessarily the writers and the bloggers of the world, but the rank and file kind of Democratic Party supporters, they completely let Obama slide on Afghanistan and Libya and Somalia and Yemen. I mean, you hear some criticism of the drone thing, I guess, but certainly they didn't rise up against the Libyan war, that kind of thing. It was sort of like this 2 years ago, where it was the Rand Pauls types who were standing up against the Libyan war at all, and then they laid down for it anyway.
No, I agree. It's just, it's certainly, I don't know what the percentages are, but I think most Americans, not people like us, but most Americans get their news from, like, networks and all that. And there are no progressive. Who are the progressive voices you're going to get there? I mean, there are, you know, it's like people
Maddow.
Think, oh, Rachel Maddow? I mean, please. I mean, it's like, but nonetheless, with that quote from Aaron Miller, it's like the people, I mean, it's just,
This is Obama's Hurricane Katrina. Remember how before Katrina, you're a jerk if you don't like Bush, and the entire burden is on you to justify your criticism. And then after Katrina, it was like, well, you know what, MJ, maybe you're right about this goofball, and maybe we don't have confidence in him. I think maybe this is that. We're finally, and it is, you know, time-wise, it's virtually 2005 for Obama, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just in his second term.
Right, exactly. It is pretty much the same time. It's funny about how presidents just fall apart in second terms. Good argument for one-term presidencies.
Yeah, no. Good argument for three- and four-term presidencies.
Keep
weak, pathetic presidents in there instead of strong, vigorous ones. That way they fail all the time to do horrible stuff to people.
That's a good point.
Bush didn't bomb Iran back in 2007 and 8.
Exactly.
You know?
That's a good point, yeah. I mean, the Israelis, you know, and Dick Cheney came to him and said, look, why not do it? I mean, it's kind of, you know.
If it takes 5 years before we hate them, then keep them for 10.
It's a good point. These are not good days for Obama, and now he's got this debt limitation thing coming up, and the Republicans are now feeling stronger, and the country's just, oh, well. It's like...
Well, now, so let me ask you about Lindsey Graham and John McCain and what they represent in American politics nowadays, because you do have the rise of Justin Amash and Rand Paul on the right, or in the Republican Party, I guess.
Great.
But you have this thing where Lindsey Graham is saying he wants to basically pass a war resolution against Iran. He's going to put together a bipartisan coalition, he says, in order to authorize war against Iran's nuclear program, if that's vague enough for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, he and McCain are definitely AIPAC boys. I mean, they are. And Lindsey Graham is always, you know, Lindsey Graham is not all that secure politically. He worries about Tea Party challenges and all. And the other thing is he really is just a lapdog for John McCain. I mean, so it's, but this is a, you know, the Republican, I wouldn't make so much about this Republican Party split. Watching Rand Paul, he seems to me like a big phony. He goes for, he'll say the right thing, and then when he gets some pressure, he switches. And his language is nauseating. Came out on the Syria thing, he made this whole thing and said something about Assad defends Christians and the other side is against Christians. He invokes this kind of right-wing kind of language. I don't trust him. I think if he runs for president, he will go to AIPAC first. I don't trust any of these guys. In fact,
I agree with you 100%.
Rand Paul, I can just see he will go to AIPAC first. They may not give him the blessing, but he'll do enough that he'll get 80% of what he needs. He'll neutralize. He'll neutralize them, and he'll neutralize himself. But I don't put as much stake in this kind of like neo-isolationism among Republicans. I see it just more as among the general public. I don't trust any of the politicians at all.
Good politics for them, and especially while they're the party out of power.
Right. I just don't. I just think I'm 65. I worked on the Hill for so long. I don't trust any of them. It's really,
tell you a story real quick, MJ.
Yeah.
In 1996, I heard Ron Paul on the radio a couple of times, but I didn't really know who he was or anything like that. But in 1997, when he first came back to Congress, I saw him on the floor of the House in the middle of the night on C-SPAN reruns saying, hey, look, the British papers have proven that George H.W. Bush was selling chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein, even up to and including during Operation Desert Shield, right before the war. What the hell? And I want to enter this into the congressional record. And then I looked at the bottom of the screen, and it said, Ron Paul, R, Texas. And I went, wow. Because, you know, like that guy Traficant, he would say some true outrageous things sometimes, but he's a raving lunatic. He would say horrible things too, stuff, and wrong stuff. But Ron Paul, to me, there's Ron Paul, and then there's every other president, every other politician in American history. There's only one of him who's that much of a truth teller. And I wouldn't put any other politician you could name in all of American history in that category with him. To me, the rest of them are all a bunch of Rand Pauls.
Well, and Rand Paul learned from his father that if you're going to be a truth teller, you're not going to become president.
Right.
So Rand Paul is just, I think in his heart, he probably believes the same things his father does, but he's just going to play the political game and try to get it. What?
I don't even give him that much credit.
Well,
I think he's just a conservative Republican, just like a conservative Republican.
That's true. Yeah, he probably is. But
he's learned
like
some
he...
of his father's rhetoric and what sounds good to people who love the best of Jefferson, you know, but...
It's kind of amazing, though. We have this ridiculous business with dynastic politics. So there's Ron Paul, who was the better of the two, but he never could go anywhere because he said things that were unacceptable. And then using his father's name, the son is now a United States Senator, and he probably has a good chance of running for president because he stands for nothing.
Yeah.
I mean,
he'll be in the primaries versus Jeb Bush, and then whoever wins between those two will take on Hillary Clinton.
And that's our system. And exactly, that is our system. I mean,
we should
really
call them all dukes and duchesses and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah,
to make it official.
Yeah. I know. It's like the they might as well have gone with the king. I mean, it turns out to even be worse than a kind of like a harmless monarchy is a lot better than this. With these families keep reproducing more and more people who inherit the rights of leadership. This is democracy. It's incredible.
Yeah, in fact, it goes back to what we were talking about, how it takes 5 years for people to finally decide that they don't like the president. If we just called them Duchess Hillary and Prince Jeb and whatever, then people would never respect them at all. It would all be blatantly illegitimate without this veneer of democratic approval having anything to do with it anymore, you know? We might be better off.
Well, I think that about, I'll never forget what some... former Soviet citizen who was a refugee here said to me, he said that in the old Soviet Union, no one believed anything the government said. In other words, if the government said it, they knew it was a lie. And he said, they were. Everything they said was a lie. But in this country, because you have the veneer of democracy, your default position is you believe the government. So we were smarter than the Soviet Union. And I think that's true. What we have is the belief that we're in control is what keeps us in line. And it's it makes us stupid.
Yeah,
it really does.
Exactly. Yeah, it's I hate to go back to it, but it's just so perfect. Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's foreign policy professor at Georgetown University, said back in 66, the only reason we let there be two parties in power, one to supposedly represent the interests of the liberals and the other of the conservatives, is so that every 8 or even 4 years, if necessary, the American people can throw those rascals out so they'll feel better about themselves. And then, but we'll just replace whoever's in power with a new team that has the exact same goals and policies in mind, but with a brand new, fresh-faced ability to carry it all out. And so, and then he lists the consensus, and the consensus is maintain the Atlantic Alliance and support Israel and keep printing money and on and on and on, the establishment consensus. None of it has anything to do with constitutional government, but it's what the wise men know is the best policy to follow through
on. Yeah, exactly. Right? They always win. And we always celebrate, you know, elections. Yay, this guy won, that guy won. It's always the same.
Just think about the tears of joy on the night Barack Obama was elected. And I remember, I'm from Texas, and I remember I was driving a cab the night that George Bush and Al Gore had their thing. And I remember at least part of the night before they announced they were going to have to keep recounting, the people, it was like almost a riot of joy in downtown Austin. As all the young Republican sons and daughters were partying at the success of George Bush, how wonderful it was. You know? It's the same thing.
Yeah, I know. And we're just duped continuously. But that's what the good news is about Syria. I don't think that the general public paid all that much attention to it. And I mean, the thing is about the distinction between Syria and Iran that we'll have to be aware of and worry about is that with Syria, it was impossible to make a case that anything that was happening in Syria affected Americans. I mean, it was just, you know, they were just having to sell it as a humanitarian thing that you were doing for another country. Mm-hmm. That's not the way they're going to sell Iran. They're going to say that, you know, if you don't, you know, they're going to make it a whole thing related to nuclear bombs, right, and threatening us and threatening Europe and threatening Israel. Yeah. But basically, they have to say it threatens us.
Yeah. We're going to debunk all those lies about Iran's nuclear threat with Mohammed Sahimi next on the show.
Oh, good, good. All right, so I don't even have to talk about it. But I would worry about that. The one way they could get America into a war is if somehow they can engineer a quote-unquote Iranian attack on an American ship or something in the region.
Yeah, never forget. As Seymour Hersh said, Dick Cheney had a plan like that. Yep. All right. Hey, thanks, MJ. That's mjrosenberg.com. Thanks very much.
Okay, Scott. Thank you.
Follow him on Twitter, too, y'all. We'll be right back with Mohammed Sahimi right after this.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track.
In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.